The Guardian.
Good to see you, everyone. Welcome to this Guardian Live event, New Horizons and Beyond. And thanks for giving up the lovely late summer evening. This year is an extraordinary one for space exploration. We've had the Rosetta mission, which has given us images from the first probe to land on the comet. New Horizons mission has transformed our view of Pluto. I remember it being just a blurry dot. Now it's this amazing world with craters and smooth plains and dunes and ice mountains that are a couple of miles high. And in December, we've got Tim Peake blasting off to the International Space Station on his first mission. But what have we learned from these missions, and what are we going to learn from Tim's and these other missions going forwards? So to help us with some of these answers, we've got a, I'm not going to say stellar, but I've said it already. We have a lovely panel of top people. We are one down. I'll say who she is very soon. We have Monica Grady, who you may recognise, who's a planetary scientist on the at the Open University. If you ever need cheering up, do watch Monica's reaction to the Philae Lander touching down on Comet 67P, because it's truly one of life's rare joys. Andrew Coates is head of planetary science at UCL's Mullard Space Science Laboratory. His team's making a camera for the European Space Agency's ExoMars rover, which is due to launch in 2018. We'll hope that date will stay. Kevin Fong is a medical doctor with a special interest in space medicine. There's a lot more I could say about him, but it will take too long. Kevin is giving this year's Royal Institution Christmas lectures, and the theme is going to be how to survive in space. So we may get a bit of a preview of some of the things he's going to be doing then. How we're going to do this evening is we're going to... Oh, sorry, let me just say a bit about who's going to join us halfway through so we don't need to stop. Maggie Adarin Pocock is coming. She's a presenter on Sky at Night, and she's a research fellow at UCL. I may ask her about this when she turns up, but her childhood dream was to go and visit the Clangers, which I remember. And she said if that doesn't happen, she'll settle for retiring on Mars. So we've got plenty of questions for her when she comes along. How we're going to do it is Monica will start off with her just talking through some of the pictures of from the Rosetta mission and just talk to us about what we've actually got from that mission and what we might be getting looking forwards. Then we'll be talking to Andrew about ExoMars and Kevin about some of the limits of space, of human space exploration. And then when Maggie comes along, we can get her to talk about Pluto and what New Horizons has told us. And then once we've had a chat, we'll hand it over to questions for you lot, because you're the ones that matter here. Monica, do you want to take us through...
Yeah, sure.
Rosetta.
Clicker. Right, okay. So the brief I was given was produce five slides, your favourite five slides of the Rosetta mission. So obviously I've got six, naturally. And the ones I've chosen are, you know, taking us through the Rosetta mission. This is a picture of Comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko. And this was taken in July, very beginning of July 2014. And this is the first picture that we'd got which showed the comet was not the shape that we'd been expecting. Okay, up until then we'd been modeling the idea of the comet as being some irregular shaped potato or peanut shaped. They're the technical descriptions which have always been used for comet shapes up to now. This image came and, you know, scientists went, oh duck, or something very, very similar to that, because this was not what we are expecting. And the problem with this is that if you're going to land something on a body, you need to know what the attraction is between the two bodies, all right? And to know that, you've got to know the mass of the two bodies. And to know the mass of a body, you've got to have an idea of its density, its volume, its shape. And so all the modelling for getting Philae to land on the comet was assuming it was something irregular, but not as irregular as this. So immediately all the engineers went, oh, no, we won't be able to land. And then, well, all right, we'll give it a go. So it was like, right, okay, this is really interesting. Because what we don't know is, still don't know, is this, you know, two bodies that have come together, or is it one body that has been sort of carved out by jets and things like that? And it's like, right, okay, this is absolutely fascinating. So this is the first picture. The second picture, clicker is this one. All right. Now, this is Feli. It's a bit pixelated because it's not a high-resolution image. And this is Feli. Bye-bye, Feli. This is the lander going to the comet. This was a picture taken from the Rosetta spacecraft on November the 14th last year. And so this was seeing Feli in the distance. And we saw this when we were at Darmstadt at the operations centre waiting. You know, so this happened at 10 o'clock in the morning and we were going to have to wait until 5 o'clock in the afternoon, 7 hours. And the way I remember it was 2 years prior to this, NASA had had its, 7 minutes of terror when the Curiosity rover was coming through Mars's atmosphere and there was no communication. So they had 7 minutes of terror. We had 7 hours of boredom, okay? But it was just like nail-biting, really nail-biting. Was it going to land? Was it going to land in the right place? And eventually we got the signal and it landed and it was absolutely fantastic. We then heard almost instantly that it had landed and bounced and landed and bounced. And so there was more concern. Was it actually, had it actually landed in the right place? So my next picture is of the landing site. Nope. Right, okay, now let's see if this will work. Okay, so this is where it was supposed to land, and it was supposed to land in the middle of this sort of sunlit plain, which is flat, no boulders, no great big sort of steep inclines, no great big holes in it. And so this is where Feli was going to land. And it had to be somewhere sunny because it had a permanent battery on it, which had 70 hours worth of time. And it had then solar cells, which would charge up another battery. And so we could do the first tranche of science using the permanent battery, but to get additional science, which was all planned for, we needed to have the solar cells charging up. Well, of course, it didn't land there. It landed somewhere sort of over there-ish. We still don't know exactly where it landed because although there's communication now between Feli and the Rosetta orbiter, the communication isn't regular and steady enough for a two-way communication to be established. But we did the most enormous amount of science there in the 70 hours. A lot of it has been published already. There's another set of stuff coming out in a journal very, very soon. We found that the particular stuff that I'm interested in... Oh, and Ian, shut me up when I've spoken too long, all right? I told you I'd waffle on, but you must shut me up. We got some really great results about the carbon and the nitrogen and the sulfur from our particular instrument. So we've got some really, really great stuff. We're not certain that we found the building blocks of amino acids, but we've certainly found the building blocks of sugars, which is very, very important for life as well. So that's that one. What's the next one? Oh, this is one of my favourite pictures. This is an image showing part of the neck of the comet. And when we interpret pictures of Mars and Pluto and these other planets, we tend to think of them in terms of the processes that go on the Earth. We tend to think of volcanoes, of craters, of sediments laid down. And when you look at this picture, you might think, well, hang on a minute, we've got something here that looks like a U-shaped valley that's been carved by a glacier. It looks as if there's wind-blown sands on the base of that. This wall here are these sediments, layers of sediments that have been tilted, or are they layers of lavas laying one on top of another? None of that can apply to this comet. Terrestrial geological processes cannot be used to interpret the landforms on the comet, which makes things really, really interesting when we try and explain what these are and how they've been formed. And I think this is my final pic. Oh, no, it's not. All right. So this is the other another aspect of the comet. Okay, this is a set of images taken at perihelion when the comet was closest to the sun. And what you're seeing there are the jets outgassing from the comet. Now, the comet is incredibly dark. It's incredibly black. So it doesn't seem to have ice on the surface. What we're seeing here are jets of dust coming out as pockets suddenly burst, and you get a sublimation of ice and then lots of dust. And what's really interesting is there's so much dust. It's a really, really active comet. But when you're looking up close, you don't get that impression at all. But it actually is an incredibly dusty environment, so dusty that the Rosetta orbiter has had to retreat further and further away from the nucleus because so much dust was coming off it. It was upsetting its navigational cameras. And this is my last picture, okay? This is in June we heard that Philae actually had woken up. It's like, yes, it's great. It's talking to us, and it is talking to us. It's just we're not answering it very well, which is incredibly frustrating because all the Philae instrument people, shut up, Ian says, all the Philae instrument people are, you know, waiting, but we've got to give time to the, you know, the coma dust plasma people to get there, which Andrew is one of them.
Meanwhile.
Okay, so that's Rosetta for you.
Yeah. Meanwhile, this very week, of course, we've got Rosetta actually is going to do an excursion to look at the plasma stuff upstream. So currently it's orbiting at about 350 kilometres or something, or 450 kilometres. And then it's going to actually do an excursion to about 1,500 kilometres away to look for the bow shock. This is the hunt for the bow shock upstream of the comet. So that's the bit where we're really interested.
So the bow shock being what exactly?
Well, this is to do with the way that the solar wind, which is a million tonnes per second of material, a billion tonnes per second coming away from the sun all the time, how that interacts with the cometary environment. So the activity which Monica talked about, the dust and the gas coming off the comet, that gets ionised and you get a large interaction. So it's what causes the plasma tail ultimately, and we're interested in that process. So the best way you can do that is actually to fly a little bit away from the comet, look at this process, and then come back again. So that's the plan, to actually do that later. But that actually starts on Wednesday this week.
Okay. You're going to learn an awful lot, and you have learned a lot about this object. But you know, as a journalist, I'm used to asking dumb questions. Why study the comet, a comet?
As a scientist, I'm used to answering dumb questions from journalists. Well, the reason we want to study a comet is that it's a part of the original material that formed the solar system. So when you think about how our star and planets formed, there was a huge cloud of gas and dust which collapsed to form a disk. And, you know, the sun in the middle is burning hot. The planets have formed from this dust, but they've changed enormously as they formed. There are the asteroids, some of which have changed, some of which, you know, have changed a little bit. But comets are this pristine material. They're full of carbon. They're full of carbon that's come from molecules from this cloud. They're things that we're studying because they've been brought to all the different planets by comets because they fly through the solar system. They're full of water. They're full of ice. They're telling us they're a time capsule. Ooh, Kevin's going, but it is
interesting, I think, because, you know, from an astronomer's point of view, from a planetary geologist's point of view, we always look for these bits of exotic chemistry out there in space. We're always surprised when we find them, and you think there's a bit of amino acid, and we always do this thing. And I used to sort of think of this as the start of life, as this stuff raining down on planets and seeding life. But of course, well, I don't know, but there are certainly a lot of people who say that all that tells you is that this chemistry happens quite easily, and that if it can happen in interstellar space, it's certainly going to happen on the surface of a planet with higher temperatures and higher pressures. And so
why hasn't it?
Well, yeah, that's the gazillion dollar question. But I always think it's, you know, we're always looking for life, and we're always looking for those answers. And I think it's always tempting to see complex organic chemistry and interstellar media and go, well, that's it, that's how life started. But actually, you know, that bioenergetic argument is that all this really tells us is that this type of chemistry happens everywhere and quite easily.
Yeah, but I mentioned, you know, building blocks of sugars, but when I was just answering Ian's question then, I didn't say anything about life. I just said this is the most primitive, pristine material. So this is the solid stuff. This is the dust, you know, the dust beneath our feet. This is the sort of stuff that's been produced. And how is it being produced? And is it being produced around other stars? What are the ingredients of planets around other stars? Are there cometary clouds going around other stars, around other planetary systems? And so if we can learn so much about the primitive material that formed our own planetary system, then we can look to other planetary systems, exoplanets, and start thinking, wow, you know, what's out there?
But elsewhere within our own solar system, there's fantastic examples as well, aren't there? So Titan, one of the moons of Saturn, with its wonderful atmosphere, nitrogen and methane, and at the top of that atmosphere, we actually, with the Cassini spacecraft, discovered huge organic and nitrile molecules, mm-hmm. which are being made, mm-hmm. you know, by the mm-hmm. interaction with sunlight and with particles from the magnetic field environment of Saturn, and creating this really complex chemistry again there. So wherever you look, you know, things end up, it seems more complex than you had expected. And I think Rosetta is showing us fantastic.
My husband, Ian Wright, who designed the Ptolemy instrument, and he's the leader of the Ptolemy instrument on Philae.
I thought it was just an Arsenal striker.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of.
Well, you know, he's a man of many talents. and he described this as frozen primordial soup, the comet.
Yeah. But Monica, I was going to ask you about Ptolemy, the instrument, which is on Philae.
Yeah.
You're trying to take measurements with this piece of kit on a pretty small lander that is essentially lost. Okay, it wasn't lost for a while. Let me get away with that.
We know it's not lost.
Get away with that.
We know exactly where it is, roughly.
Yeah, that's so super harsh. Because,
anyway,
frankly, yeah. if I'd travelled hundreds of millions of miles and landed on a comet, I would go and have a lie down out of the sun as well.
Yeah, it's not lost.
My question being, just tell us how you're sniffing the atmosphere, whatever you would call it. Did you take measurements on the way down? Did you take some actually on the surface?
We didn't take any direct measurements on the way down. I think Maggie's arrived.
Maggie, welcome. Good to see you.
So we didn't take any measurements on the way down, but we did take measurements actually on the surface. And what we did was we turned the fact that the probe bounced into an advantage. And what we've done is we've sampled dust probably from three separate locations on the comet, which we wouldn't have been able to do if it had landed and stayed where it is. So, you know, it's this field expedition that Philae did has enabled us to look at two separate fractions of the comet. So we breathed in the environment around the comet, around the surface of the comet when Philae landed, and we've got one set of results from that. And then the dust, which actually entered the ovens that we've got on the comet, we managed to heat one of those up, and it was Ptolemy that drained the battery. We took the last 3 volts from the battery to heat our ovens up to analyse the dust as well. And that gave us a completely different set of measurements, which is, you know, really interesting.
Did you get a density profile as it bounced? Is it like the moon? Does it have like mass concentrations in it in different places of different materials? Like, what can you tell that?
I don't know the answer to that, but I'm sure some of the radio people would probably be able to answer that question. But our instrument didn't.
Yeah, no, I mean, one of the other things which it was possible to do was to look at the magnetic field in these different locations and to find out for sure that the comet is not magnetized. Mm. Now, we knew that, but down to a scale of 1 meter, it was able to actually do that by flying over the surface and being able to look at different locations. So that was another sort of good advantage.
I remember covering the landing as it was sort of going on, and for all the fantastic news of this thing happening, of you pulling it off, the information came through that, first of all, the thruster on top of Philae that was supposed to hold it down to stop it bouncing was out of gas, so that wasn't going to work. Well, there was a problem with it.
We knew that at 10 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
Or we'd known it from the middle of the night before.
Yeah. And then, secondly, the harpoons to hold it down don't seem to have worked.
Yeah.
So now, Philae's resting on the surface, and you're also at the point where the comet is getting to its most active now. And the last figures I saw was something like 300 kilograms of dust coming off per second and a ton of water a second.
Mm.
Is Philae just going to get blown off?
Well, if a vent opens up directly underneath where it is, then yes. Now, if Philae had landed where it should have landed, then it would be defunct now, because it would have been frazzled, fried by the direct sunlight as it came into perihelion. But because it's shaded, partly shaded, and it's still partly shaded, because they've had enough information back to say which solar panels are actually charging up, and so it's still partially shaded. So it's unlikely that it's going to be blown off unless something opens up directly underneath it.
I think we'll come back to hear more about Rosetta and Comet 67P, but I want Maggie to talk about New Horizons and Pluto, if you're ready to, Maggie. That would be great.
Yes.
Thanks.
First of all, my apologies, I'm not Chris Lintott. Chris unfortunately got stuck in the States, and we are interchangeable now, so I'm curious. So I wanted to talk about the Pluto New Horizons mission. And first of all, I'd like to speak about my excitement. Well, I must admit, my excitement was muted when I heard about sort of a mission to Pluto. And it sort of really took sort of 9.5 years to get there. And when the Sky at Night was invited to go and sort of witness the monumental sort of flyby, I was thinking, well, it's going to be interesting, but not that interesting. Boy, was I wrong. Now, I think one of the reasons why this flyby was so interesting was this was the best image we had of Pluto, let's say a year ago. And this was taken by the Hubble Space Telescope. And effectively, it's a round blob with patchy bits. And that's as technical as it got. We didn't really know much more about it. But the joy of New Horizons is it's actually really updated our knowledge. Now, one of the reasons we don't know much about Pluto is because it's diddy. I'm going to actually read this out. So Pluto is 2,372 kilometres. That is diddy, much smaller than the Moon. And actually, this is Pluto and its main moon, Charon. And you could fit them across the United States of America. So they're 49 astronomical units away from the Sun at its maximum extent. So it's not very surprising that something that diddy, that far away, we don't know much about it. And so New Horizons did really shed light on a new dwarf planet out there. And these are some of the images we've been getting back, and it's been fantastic. I'm getting ahead of myself. When we actually sort of actually started getting the close-up images, it was mind-boggling. Because one of the things was, as it's a flyby, we get sort of more and more images. It's like a tease campaign. You get a bit more data, you get a bit more data, you get a higher resolution image, but you know tomorrow you're going to get an even higher resolution image. And this is sort of shows just some of the amazing features. And effectively, the title that people are generally using now is Pluto, It's Complicated. Because what we were expecting was sort of probably a fairly pocked, crater-riven surface. But now we're seeing that there are areas of cratering, there are areas with huge mountains, but there are also these smooth areas. And these smooth areas are turning out to be quite a mystery, because why are they smooth? It's out there in the Kuiper Belt. It should be sort of bombarded, and it's been out there for probably quite a while. So why do we get these amazing smooth areas? What's renewing the surface and getting rid of the craters that would otherwise be there? And so all sorts of theories have been coming up. And that's one of the great things about being out there with New Horizons and as the news was coming out, because you get scientists who usually stop and consider images for a long time before making any pronouncements. But they were sort of shoved in front of television cameras, given an image they'd just seen and said, what do you think? And quite often the answer was, we don't know, it's just amazing. So that's one of the things I really enjoyed about the whole New Horizons mission. But to put it all into perspective, I want to show this image, because this is, to me, the pace of space science today. 94, that was the best image we had of Pluto. 2010, that was the best image. July 14th, that was the best image we had today. And that image is getting more and more detailed. We're looking at structures of the order of half a mile diameter on the surface. And so this is the pace of space science, and I think there's a lot more to come. Thank you.
Maggie, can I ask you, it's an interesting one that you can have flat, smooth surfaces on somewhere like Pluto, because it's so small you can't imagine there being much in the way of radioactive heat coming from the centre, but there's nothing really much nearby that's going to be big enough to kind of squeeze it like a squash ball to warm it up like that. But somehow it's being heated up, right?
So it's
what's
got,
going on?
Well, that is the million-dollar question.
Yeah.
And it's got Charon close by. Mm. And Charon and Pluto are more like a binary system. Because if you look at the Barry Centre, it's actually above Pluto's surface. So they're sort of orbiting each other. So with the Earth and Moon, our Moon is incredibly big. But Charon is even bigger compared with the size of Pluto. And so it's actually in orbit. In orbit about a common Barry centre. And so that movement, we don't think that's enough to cause the sort of activity, because there must be some sort of internal heating inside Pluto, and that's what we can't get to grips with at the moment. We don't actually know what's causing that.
Would that be tied into... One of the things I find lovely about this is these ice mountains. They're probably ice, and they seem to be about 3 kilometres high. And something must have pushed these things up, which, you know, over on Earth you would start thinking about tectonics and
yes.
so on. But what is this another head-scratcher?
It is. And I think there'll be more head-scratchers to come, because we have got these huge ice batches, and as you say, plate tectonics, but we can't see any dynamics or any method of having plate tectonics like that on Pluto.
One of the things that has really fascinated me seeing the Pluto stuff is comparing it with Ceres. The asteroid, or the Dawn mission, is at Ceres at the moment. And Ceres is much smaller than Pluto. It's about 1,000 kilometres across. So it's half the size. But Ceres looks as if it's got ice mountains and craters and flat bits and stuff like that.
So it's really causing us to rethink smaller planets.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Because there's another comparison with Europa, isn't there? The Europa, one of the moons of Jupiter, which, of course, has got subsurface ocean, we know that.
But
with there's these
Jupiter.
Chaos regions there which look a little
but
bit
with
like...
But Jupiter, you've got, with
sure.
Europa, you've got Jupiter.
Absolutely.
You've got the squash ball effect.
Absolutely. So here we're missing it to some extent, although people do think that maybe there is something about this Barry Center rotation thing that, you know, something sloshing around or whatever inside.
Although they're so small, the gravitational forces must be pretty minimal.
Yeah.
But yes.
Yeah,
but it's exciting stuff. One of the interesting things is they've got a huge amount of data, because when they did the flyby, it was quite interesting, because we were waiting sort of in sort of mission control, and for a long time New Horizons was just looking at Pluto, and when it's looking at Pluto it can't send any data back, which was a very, very tense time, looking at Pluto, getting as much data as possible, and then when it goes beyond it sort of turns back and says, yeah, I've got something, and then continues. But the data rate back to Earth is 1K. So it's going to take of the order of 18 months to get all the information back. So we know on board there's a whole lot of fantastic information which has been drip-fed to the scientists a little bit at a time. And so each time we get a new image, we find out a new discovery and sort of take it a bit further, and it fills in a bit more of the story.
Do you think the heating effect could be due to some unseen third body? It's very difficult to see how there's enough energy in that system for that heating to happen.
And also, because the way New Horizons did its trajectory, it was actually looking out for other things out there. And unless it was very, very cunning, we haven't seen anything out there. I don't think there's another body. But it is still quite a mystery. But that's what I love. Pluto, which looked fairly dull and boring, is throwing out mysteries.
And also, I mean, the fact that it's red, you know, it's a little bit red. And that's another interesting fact that you can see that on the image there. And that's fantastic. So it's maybe tholins. Yeah, so a little bit like in Titan's atmosphere, where you have the methane and nitrogen atmosphere there producing this stuff, which comes down to the surface and produces dunes on the surface. It looks like we have something similar at Pluto, although the atmosphere is much thinner, but nevertheless, it might have been thicker in the past, but it leads you to sort of make conjectures and do some modelling to say.
Because also one of the things we were very interested in is Charon, as I say, is an incredibly large moon. And I won't say they share an atmosphere, but it looks like there is some material transfer. Mm.
Yeah.
So we're actually seeing tholins on Charon as well. Mm. We don't think they were created there, so it looks as if there's some dynamic going on between the two. And Charon was fantastic, I have to say it. I mean, she just revealed, I mean, craters 600 miles long. I mean, far bigger than the Grand Canyon. And one of the moons of Pluto has thrown up all sorts of interesting ideas as well.
What I really like is that there's been discussion about, well, you know, Pluto, 'tis a planet. You know, it's been downgraded. but we should make it back into a planet.
Because it's interesting.
I think it's wrong.
I think it's wrong.
I think Pluto, I mean, it's, you know, the ninth planet, tiny, long way away, yawn. Pluto, the first Kuiper Belt object to be explored with its moons, that is much more exciting because that is saying, well, hang on a minute, if we've seen this excitement with just the one Kuiper Belt object so far, what else are we going to find out there, which is really great.
And, of course, New Horizons will be going on to another Kuiper Belt object, so there's more to come.
Since you've raised the question, I was going to ask the audience this anyway. What's your views on whether Pluto should be a planet or whether it should be regarded as it is now, which is technically a dwarf planet, which is not a planet? Come on, hands up. Who thinks it should be a planet? Does anyone think it should be a planet? Charlie Bolden thinks it should be a planet, the head of NASA.
I mean, well, actually, that's not... it was interpolated.
I thought it was interesting.
No, he said it fairly clearly. Yeah, he said it fairly clearly.
Because one of the early results that came out was about the size of Pluto, you know, because of course you can measure it more accurately. And it is the largest of the objects. And Alan Stern, you know, the PI of it, was very keen on making that point to say that actually it's the largest.
How convinced can you be that Pluto is roughly the same age as the other rocky objects in the solar system? Because, you know, all we know for sure is that it's been seen in history, which is a few centuries.
Yes.
I'm bothered about the energetics of this system. There is not enough energy in this system for this. Yes. Is it something that could have been produced by a relatively recent collisional process and you're just seeing the calming down of it?
We see the Kuiper Belt objects as sort of the detritus left over from the formation of the solar system. And so, although you can get collisions and then sort of formations, under the sort of under the timescales we're talking about, I think that's unlikely. I think we'd see more evidence of that collision, and we're not seeing that at all.
So what sort of age are you thinking? Are you thinking it might have been bounced into the solar system?
6,000 years.
Yeah.
like everything else.
4,004.
certainly less than the billions of years that you would probably ascribe to it as you know, as part of the family of planets or Kuiper Belt objects that are out
there. The solar system is 4,567.3821 years old.
Recurring.
That's accurate, yeah.
It is precise and it is accurate, okay? Because you all know the difference between precision and accuracy, don't you? It is a very precise age, which comes from very precise dating of components within meteorites, which you can do in the lab and you can repeat, all right? And so we know that is the age of the oldest objects within meteorites. And we don't believe there is anything older than that which makes up a main mass. I mean, there are pre-solar grains, diamonds, silicon carbide, rubies, emeralds, which seed, and carborundum, sandpaper, which seed some of the meteorites, which are older than the solar system, but they're a very, very, very minor component. So there are no big bodies that are older than that.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't thinking about older, I was thinking about newer. And when I say newer, the system is known to be that age, but components within it could have undergone catastrophic process more recently. I mean,
they have, you know,
as did the Earth moon system.
Because anything coming from outside.
But most likely,
but yes,
early
a collision
on.
But it seems unlikely because I think we'd be seeing evidence of that collision if it was that young.
Most likely in the first billion years or so, when all that stuff was flying around, you know, in the very early times. And of course, a lot of the aging of solar system objects is from crater counting, but of course here we don't have many craters, which is an interesting clue.
So we don't
leads
really
it open.
Know.
We don't really know. Yeah, we
can't count craters. We can't get down price stop example.
As we get more data coming,
that's all I was aiming for. We don't know.
As we get more data, it's absolutely right. And as we get more data coming back, you know, over the next year or so, then there's be more composition data which will help with this. But at the moment, it's exciting, but it's sort of unconstrained. Yeah.
I want to make sure we get time for you, Andrew and Kevin, before we hand over for questions. And Andrew, you're working on ExoMars, which is going to look for signs of existing life on Mars, correct?
Most likely past life, but...
So you can pick up, because I was interested in signatures, because as a total layperson, and you look at Mars, it looks very dead. And I'm wondering what motivates you to send ExoMars there, apart from the name.
Well, what we know over the last few years, you know, we found out that actually Mars is an extremely, well, we knew already it's an interesting place, but we found there have been discoveries about the history of water in the Martian system. So Mars, you know, 3.8 billion years ago used to have flowing water on the surface. There used to be volcanism. There used to be a magnetic field. All that stopped. And so, you know, something really catastrophic probably happened at that time, possibly a collision. There are some models which shows that it could have been collision, but it basically stopped. And at that time, life was developing on the Earth. And so the most likely thing for life on Mars is that there may be traces of it underneath the surface and from that early time. Current life, you know, it is a possibility. We'd see methane, so that was seen with the Mars Express orbiter and with telescope observations from the ground. The ExoMars Trace Gas Orbiter is going to be launched next March to actually look for that in more detail. But the most likely thing is geological activity rather than life, but you know, who knows? And so we need to try and answer those questions. And so the ExoMars rover, the great thing about that in 2018, the really new key thing which Europe and Russia are doing is going to be drilling under the surface of Mars for the first time to look for those things from billions of years ago, bring them up into the rover and analyse them. So to me, that's a fantastic thing which we're going to try and do on Mars for the first time, because Curiosity, with its fantastic landing system, you know, landed successfully on Mars, but it can only drill 5 centimetres underneath the surface of rocks. Mm. We're going to be able to drill 2 metres underneath the surface to really look for those past signs of life. And so, you know, it's a wonderful mission.
It's different technology than you had on Beagle, where Beagle had a kind of strange kind of sort of moving weight type system to try and tap itself down into the sort of Martian regolith, right? And I don't know what its sort of max distance was, but is this, do you just have a big drill bit?
It is basically a big drill bit, or at least 3, which are kind of, you know, attached together, and it's a drilling system. So anybody that's done drilling at home, you know, understand the difficulties with that. And, of course, we're trying to do it on another planet where...
How do you stop the rover not spinning around?
That's okay. It's heavy enough. We don't have to worry about that. But there are things we do have to worry about. So rocks underneath the surface, but we have a subsurface sounding radar to look for that. We have... that also looks for water underneath the surface, and there is a neutron detector for water underneath the surface as well in the form of ice or permafrost. So getting the right conditions to drill, that's one of the sort of first thing we're going to do. So we're going to be able to move, you know, to an interesting looking location using our camera system, you know, UK-led camera system, which has 2 wide-angle cameras 50 centimetres apart and standing about a person's height above the Martian surface. So we get better stereo reconstruction than the human eyes. We have a high-resolution camera which adds texture. We do geology with filters. We do atmospheric science. So we've packed everything into that camera system. But we're basically looking for good places to drill to look for signs of life. And so the payload is going to look for context and then to look for that drill spot, bring the stuff back into the rover and analyse it.
Tell me what these signs of life are going to be there, because in the media I get to see what other media do, and I see that every time there's a sniff of methane on Mars, scientists have found evidence for life on Mars. And after talking to a lot of astrobiologists, it's interesting to talk through actually what would constitute a good signal, or even, can we say, proof on, or, you know, whatever, as a principle, apart from catching a green guy running across the camera. what would you look for that would say, you know, gets beyond suggestive and towards, whoa, you know, are you looking, do you need actually to see some kind of cellular structure? Is it that?
That would be great, you know, it'd be nice to be able to do that.
What can you see with ExoMars?
With ExoMars, what we're going to be able to do, the analytical instruments, there's the ones which will look at the sample which is drilled and then brought into the rover. So there's an infrared spectrometer which looks at the geology, basically. There is also a Fourier spectrometer which will look for fluorescence, which can tell you about the organic chemistry going on as well. But really, I suppose the most interesting one is the Mars Organics Mass Analyzer, which is a mass spectrometer. Not as good as the one that was going to be on Beagle, but
it's
quite good. But it will look for chirality, and it will look for carbonates, and it will look for composition. So it sort of burns the samples and does some isotopic analysis as well.
What is the significance of some of these things you're mentioning, like chirality and carbonates? How do they feed into a detection for life?
Well, I mean, ultimately, it's part of the sort of setting the scene for it. Right. I mean, it won't necessarily detect, I think, actually. You know, it won't prove conclusively that there was life. It will give us a good clue and what to next look for. But it gives us, you know, more of a context and what we'll be able to do in future missions. But nevertheless, if that clue, you know, is relatively positive, and there is a little camera actually at the end of the drill bit, to actually look for the geology, but it will be able to look for other things as well. So, you know, we're going underneath the surface for the first time. Who knows what we're going to find? But it's instrumented to look for the chemical signatures, really, which would be consistent with life. But I don't think it would necessarily...
Existing or historic? I'm just saying, are you looking for, you know, signs?
It will be able to look for methane things nearby, but we are looking for both past and present life with it. So yes, looking at some of the chemistry, which the MoMA instrument can do, should give us a better constrained scenario for.
Is there a signature you can see that you know can't be achieved geologically? I mean, that's the whole issue with methane, is you can obviously produce that through things like olivine and such like. If you want to get a signature that is going to make you think, actually, this is really exciting.
Well,
be your sort of a great result for you?
Yeah, one of the interesting things is the ratio between carbon-12 and carbon-13, because that's, you know, life uses one of them and it doesn't use the other. So you can use that signature to help you to really sort of look for the life signatures. But, I mean, the whole mission, being able to sort of drill underneath the surface, as I say, that's the first time we've been able to do that. So we don't really know, you know, like with Rosetta and Pluto, you know, what we're going to be, what we're going to actually find. But it gives us more information which can then be used in future missions.
The chirality is really, really important.
Can you explain what that is?
There's nothing on Curiosity, is there, looking at chirality?
No.
All right. Chirality is your two hands, okay? You can't put them over, you can't superimpose them. They're mirror images of each other, okay? So that's like chiral things. And we tend to talk about molecules, chiral molecules, in terms of how they interact with light, how they polarise light. And we talk about them as being dextro and levorotatory, so right-handed or left-handed molecules. So, for instance, one set of chiral molecules are the things that give flavour to lemons and limes, all right? So you know how similar they are, similar but different, but they have two different, types of chiral molecule in them. Now, life tends to like, and I always get it wrong, do they like L sugars and D amino acids, or the other way wrong. You know, no, Kevin is our bona fide biologist here. Yes. Yeah, Kevin.
Don't ask me. hand out antibiotics and people got sore throats.
Chemistry tends to give you equal numbers of L and D, and biology fractionates give you different amounts. And so if we get different amounts, then it's a good signature. It's not proof positive, because there are non-biological processes which can give you an excess of one over the other. And one of the biggest problems that we've got to circumvent is there is huge amounts of micrometeorites and meteorite matter which falls on the surface of Mars, and some of that is organic matter that has been produced non-biologically. And so to be able to tell the difference between meteorite and something indigenous to Mars, and that's one of another reason why we've got to drill.
Yes, and the drilling, you know, is really important, because you're going away not only from the sort of infall of meteorites on the surface, but also from the very oxidizing atmosphere on the surface, the sort of hostile environment in terms of radiation. There's a radiation environment which is higher than on the Earth's surface. Although there is a thin atmosphere, it doesn't alleviate the radiation environment very much. And ultraviolet, you know, more ultraviolet, which gets through that thin atmosphere as well. So it's a really hostile environment for life on the surface. So drilling under the surface is so important, and this is the first mission to be able to do it. So 2018, hopefully.
Maggie.
Because I think the drill is a very sort of unique feature of ExoMars.
Yeah.
But I also love, and I just like saying it, the autonomous navigation. Because the two cameras you were mentioning means that, because the sort of Spirit and Opportunity on Mars at the moment, they are controlled from Earth. So it's on the surface. You want to move a metre forward. So it's like, okay, move a metre forward, and it takes sort of 12 and a half minutes for that signal to go to the rover, and then it will move forward a metre, and then it will stop, and it will wait for the next instruction. With ExoMars, we've got autonomous navigation, so it actually uses those two cameras to map the terrain, and it works out its own movement over that surface. So to me, this is another leap forward in technology in terms of rovers, where it's not artificial intelligence, but it's getting a bit closer. So, and I find that really exciting.
Yeah.
I want to bring Kevin in now. Kevin, you've seen what these guys are doing with robots. It's hard enough doing the stuff with robots, right? How much harder does it get when you throw people into the equation, when you're trying to do stuff in space with people?
So yeah, I mean, I think human presence in space is a massively double-edged sword, isn't it? You know, you get the flexibility and the vulnerability at the same time. That's why you have humans in the loops of any systems that we have today. And it's interesting that we talk about the rovers, and you know, Spirit and Opportunity have been wildly successful.
Oh, yeah.
Wildly successful. Opportunity now, in the 11 years it's been on Mars, you know, it's operating 10 and a half years beyond its expected lifetime. It's brilliant, and you can't deny, except in 11 years it's driven 25 miles, which is the distance the Apollo 15 crew drove in 3 afternoons. You know, and so in terms of flexibility and mobility, there is something humans still have to offer. You know, and there's no part of, and I think it is a false dichotomy, really, between sort of saying, is it robots or is it humans? I mean, for the foreseeable future, at least in my mind, it is going to be a partnership between the two, and there are some locations in the solar system which only automated platforms can be deployed, and there are some in which actually possibly still humans are the best option. And I say this, and yeah, this may change, although I would put it to you that at the point at which robot kind is capable of outperforming us in every way, in every sense, you've got much more to worry about than whether or not they should be out there exploring space or not. I refer you to Terminator. And so the thing for me is that, and the discussion, and I think it's an interesting thing that's happened with astronomy in the 21st century, really. It begins to dovetail towards this need for us all to understand the origins of the our planet and the conditions which were able to support life and allow life to first arise. And, you know, what we know about that is actually relatively little. What we know is the first iteration of life on Earth arose between 3.85 and 3.5 giga-year ago. That evidence comes from rocks taken out of the Western Australian desert, which were not found by parachuting R2-D2 into Australia. It was found by teams of geologists going in after decades, banging on rocks that looked out of place and finding it. So you know, I think there is still a place for human explorers in this environment, and there may come a time when they are superseded. But I think there's still a huge job of work to do on the Moon and on Mars, certainly.
I want to ask you about the hostility of the place, because we all know space is hostile. These guys might not know that you also applied to be an astronaut at the same time Tim Peake did.
So did I.
Yeah. Okay, you're 2-4.
Just for the record.
I applied to be an astronaut when Helen Sharman.
Okay. Kevin gets to fly around as a flying doctor in a helicopter for Kent, Sussex and Surrey.
Yeah.
And it, so you're getting, I don't know how many miles that is up, but when you start going into, when you're in space, just give us a sense of just how hostile it is. We all know it's a vacuum, we all know it's high up, but how, it's more than that, right?
So, I mean, it's a total horror show in a way that I think is very difficult to appreciate when you see it filmed in HD on a wide-angle lens with everyone waving at their mum and dad. And we don't put it in that category of expedition like we do marching to the pole or to the summit of Everest or into deserts, when in fact it completely is. And it's completely the same in the respect that what we know about this extreme environment is you can go there, but it takes a lot to protect you, and it's not for long, and it's not without penalty. And as soon as you deploy, you feel it. They may be smiling, but actually they're having a bad time, and they're having a bad time from the moment they deploy. So I worked with medical operations at NASA for a while, and you know, they'd tell you the catalogue of things they dealt with. And when you deploy for the first 48 hours, about 3/4 of the astronauts are sick or feel sick. the most prescribed medication for astronaut crews is anti-sickness followed by sleeping tablets. They feel like they're standing on their heads all the time because all the reflexes that stop blood pooling in your legs on Earth are unopposed, and so they just push the blood up into your head. So if you see a photograph of someone you know, and I've had mates who've flown, and you see them in space, and they go, oh, Dan's put on a few pounds. And actually, it's just the fluid being pushed into their head, and they feel, because of that, they feel like they've permanently got a cold while they're up there. It affects their sense of taste. And so it's just genuinely unpleasant, and that's before you get into sort of going to the loo and not having showers and things. It is an expedition like any other expedition. It's unpleasant and hostile and life-threatening at every moment.
I've heard that their faces can sort of, I don't know if it's retaining fluid, but they can sort of puff up so much that they look loads younger because their wrinkles are kind of like straightened out. And so
It definitely smooths out the wrinkles.
Space
Botox. Makes you look like you,
What is Tim going to, maybe not struggle with is unfair, but what is it, you've given us some flavour of what it's like as soon as you get there. Tim Peake's going up in December. He's going up for 5 or 6 months or so. Is what's that going to be like when he comes back? Or is it actually when he's up there that it's going to be the toughest bit?
So it's both. You have some instant adaptation problems when you arrive, but your body's remarkable, really, given that, as far as we can tell, evolution occurred in an unchanging 1G environment over 3.85 odd billion years. You deploy in this environment with no gravitational load due to free fall. Your genome actually makes some very appropriate changes. It says, well, you don't need all that muscle bulk to carry around because I'm not supporting you against gravity, so I'm going to waste those muscles. That's appropriate. You've got a set of muscles on you that are anti-gravity muscles. So if you think of what you do when you stand up from a chair, all those muscles you're putting into action are your anti-gravity muscles. Without them, you'd just curl up under the force of gravity in a fetal position on the ground. And it says you don't need all that bone either.
You'd be
sludge rolling around on the floor. But it says you don't need that bone either, so it wastes some of your bone, puts that calcium in your bloodstream, and you pee that out. Mm. And your sense of balance and coordination is thrown off. Most of this is adaptive. But when you come home, it's maladaptive, because you then have to deal with all that load again. And when they come back, it's really interesting. Something like about 65 to 70% of rookie astronauts when they come can't do a 10-minute stand test, which is, you say, stand there. And before they fly, you say to them, is this a test? I'm an astronaut. What is it? How is this a test? Stand here for 10 minutes. And then they come back, and you stand them up, and 70% of them sort of sweat. And then after a few minutes, they say, I've got to sit down, I'm going to faint. You go, yeah, you're an astronaut. and then they have this step test.
Some of this vestibulary, or is this
all so that one is all because your heart is a muscle pump that does work against gravity. It has a set of reflexes that works so that when someone rings the doorbell and you're lying on your sofa watching a movie and you stand up, you don't faint. It has to say, oh, I know what you're doing, you're standing up. It increases your blood pressure, keeps the blood flowing to your brain. All of that reflex gets deconditioned in space.
How quickly does that deconditioning happen? I mean, if you're up there for a week and you come back, you can stand up for the 10 minutes.
Well, the shuttle crews were only ever up for about 2 weeks at a time maximum. They were variable in their susceptibility to it. But if on the old shuttle films, when you looked at the people coming off and waving, the number of people who came out of the shuttle was not always the number of people who'd got on it in the first place. And there were sometimes one or two who were lying in their seats saying, just leave me alone. I'm not doing CNN today. And a flight doctor and a couple of flight nurses to go on and actively resuscitate these people and give them fluids and try and get them back on their feet. It's why the Russians bring their crews down in the middle of Kazakhstan and they're out of view of everybody, really.
But this leads on to something I was really keen to ask you about, which is we are ridiculously, in a way, but used to people being on the International Space Station, falling around Earth at 240 miles up or what have you. But people are now talking about whether we should be doing something on the moon, whether, there's a lot of talk about a human Mars mission. Mm. Are the problems you're talking about just not showstoppers for that? You might be physically alive when you get there, but can you build somewhere? Can you do something useful? And then even when you come back, it sounds as if it'd be even worse.
So I would say this, that space we tend to refer to as though it's one location. It's a fairly big place. There are lots of destinations in it. And I think the moon is very different from Mars as a location. I think the moon is both reachable and explorable by humans now in a comprehensive way. I would put it to you that by the middle of this century, you could easily build an infrastructure in which made the moon as accessible as Antarctica was in the middle of the last century. You know, if
inaccessible then.
Well, accessible to the point where by the time you and I were at university, we could have applied to go to the British Antarctic Survey straight out of it, with nothing than a health check from your GP. and so, you know, the moon is within that range of capability, and you could see easily a future in which, you know, our kids, who are sort of under 10 now, could be the sorts of people who one day apply for some job with the British Lunar Survey. Well, probably not British.
And this is because the distance.
but because it's relatively close.
So you can go on short duration trips in and out.
In and out, yeah. I think it's okay. And you can imagine an outpost there. You know, if we had this conversation 100 years ago and you said to me, you know, 1915, you know, what are the chances do you think our kids will have professional scientist jobs working in Antarctica? You'd have said, no chance at all. And yet, by the middle of that century, that's exactly what was happening. By the end of that century, people were going on guided tours down there. So I don't know that you can call it. I think that the moon is well within our capability. I think Mars needs technology, and I think that technology is not life science and biological. I think it's enabling propulsive technology and artificial gravity to protect you. But I don't think that's beyond our ken. It's whether or not we want to do it and whether we think it's worth our while.
So you think you would, and this is something that I should know, but I can understand how you don't have the load from gravity as you're falling around the Earth, because all you're doing is falling, essentially, but just going at 17,500 miles an hour sideways, so you constantly miss the planet. But if you're flying out to Mars, what I don't know sort of how the gravitational pull on you changes.
The reason you're weightless in Earth orbit is not because there's no gravity. You know, actually you've got a good more than 90% of the gravity, because your separation from the center of mass of the Earth is not that much different from that at the surface. And in orbit around the Earth, you're in that lift that someone's cut the cable in, only it never hits the ground, so it doesn't spoil the ride. And so you're just falling and floating all the while. Now, what it's difficult to appreciate is when you're on your way to Mars, you are also in an orbit. You're just not in an orbit around the Earth anymore. You're in a solar orbit. And so you're still in free fall. In fact, I always say this, that space flight is a misnomer. It's space fall. All you do is you launch yourself and then you fall towards your target. And you hope you miss it, usually, until you get there.
Before we go to the audience for questions, I wanted to ask Maggie something, and I'm sure others of you do. I think you work with with schools and so on, and I'm really interested in whether the missions... this year has been a bonanza year for anyone in the press like me who does science stuff, because, you know, we've had Rosetta, we've had New Horizons, and a whole load of other missions we haven't even got onto. But are these missions inspiring kids? The way we hear the Apollo missions inspire kids, you know, back in the... who are going to school in the 60s, or are these missions being lost on them? Not lost on them, but no. Are they not having
a... I don't think they have the impact of the Apollo missions, because the Apollo missions were a global phenomena. And Rosetta, for instance, and New Horizons were too. I remember being at Rosetta in Darmstadt and actually seeing the Google logo come up, and there was a little filet. And I thought, hey, the world knows! So I think it had an impact. But in terms of the kids, I think it's less of an impact. And mainly because, I won't say they're spot, but they're surrounded by lots of information. And sometimes the images we... give to them are not a patch on what they're seeing in cartoons and films and things like that. And so with the Apollo moon landings, this was the first time anyone had seen anything like it. It was mind-boggling. It was sort of all-encompassing. It was just quite sort of surrounding. But I think kids are sort of surrounded by so much other stuff that it doesn't have the same impact. And also, I think manned missions, or peopled missions, I should correct, also have a much bigger impact than some of the robotic missions. Yeah. So I think the kids are appreciating it, but it doesn't have the same impact as the moon landings or things like that.
And we saw even with the moon landings that, you know, by the time you got to, well, Apollo 13, you know, interest had gone.
So there's a lot of... it's really interesting because actually we all think that everyone was up for the moon landings. Actually, there are some pretty comprehensive polls which show that even in America, public approval for Apollo didn't reach 50% until the summer of 69 when Armstrong and Aldrin get on the moon, and then it only lasts a little while and everyone gets fed up. Yes. So public approval for Apollo was actually, in America, even America was quite small because of the enormous amount of cash it cost.
Yeah.
Public approval for Shuttle, as you were, you know, which all the media would have you believe, you know, well, it was just kept going up and everyone didn't care, was 60 to 70% and increased after the disasters, not decreased. And so, you know, there's a story we tell about those things. Actually, when you look at Apollo, public interest was pretty much followed the level of investment of the government. Actually, the number of technical PhDs and degrees goes down only after the government starts defunding it. And so the real story of Apollo is the government blinked first, only that's not what a government would want you to see.
Although missions like Voyager, you know, were also really inspirational for a generation, you know, the sort of next generation on. So that, seeing the outer planets for the first time, just amazing. I mean, we're doing that at the moment with Cassini, you know, still at Saturn, still sending back fantastic images. And the Pluto New Horizons image the other day, the one with the haze on it, just
yes,
amazing.
So, the atmosphere.
But I suppose it's already sold on me. Yeah,
but it's just incredible how short the history of doing that is, because I had the great pleasure of speaking with Bill Harmon, who was the PI on the camera on Mariner 4. I think that must have been 64, right? 1964. This is the first time that anyone's taking photographs of Mars, and he talks about, you know, being a shot of this camera that sort of took like, you know, five snaps, you know, snap, 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 he said, as it went by. And then they sat there, and you talk about 1K download. Like, it was weeks and weeks and weeks before they got this little raster.
Yeah.
And back then, you know, they were disappointed because they were expecting to see possibly civilizations. But, you know, even then, in 64, and they're like, what? This is all it is. Yeah. And, you know, this is like a 50-year history of this thing. So it's short. And my favourite quote from one of the people we were talking to about that was, you know, when I said to them, how much of a game changer will it be for us if we discover extant microbial life on Mars? And it was one of the scientists at JPL we were talking to. And she said, well, up until about 60 years ago, we thought there was towns and cities. We came to terms with that. It's not going to be that big of a deal. I don't think
it would be that big of a deal, actually, because, I mean, in 1996, some scientists thought they'd found a bacterium in a Martian meteorite. And there was amazing, publicity for a couple of weeks. And that has never been publicly retracted. Mm. So lots of people might still think that there are bacteria on Mars. It hasn't changed one iota the way we think of ourselves as a civilization.
Everyone, can we give these guys a round of applause? I think they've been great.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.